Scene 3, 12 to 17. David, there's a spot up here if you want to come up. It sets the stage for revenge as Joseph is sent out yet again to report on the condition of the flocks and his brothers. Scene 4 presents the brothers' conspiracy to destroy Joseph and render his dreams mute, and we see that in verses 18 to 28. And then we end again with this distinctive family birthmark of deception as the boys go back and deceive their father with regard to what happens with Joseph. So in verses 29 to 36. So a pretty full narrative, and we'll kind of dwell a bit here on the dream up front, but let's get started. Somebody read verses 5 to 11 for me, please. Okay, so two dreams, developing the plot line here in verses 5 to 11. Now, remember we had homework last week, right? Anybody do their homework? You're all supposed to nod your heads yes. Tori, you're off the hook. You weren't here last week, so you don't have to do that. But what's that? No, I don't want you to lie. But you could be deceptive since we are in chapter 37 and we are talking about Joseph and Jacob here. Okay, so the first assignment was, beyond the obvious message of the preeminence that we see in the dreams, what do the two dream metaphors symbolize or communicate? What do the two things symbolize or communicate?
The sun, the moon, and the stars, that's first or second.
Yeah, okay. So what do they symbolize? What more might we draw out of the dreams in terms of what's trying to be conveyed? First one was the sheath. The second one was the sun, the moon, and the stars. And they all responded at once. David.
Is his mother dead at this point?
Is Joseph's mother dead?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Jacob? Yeah. Yeah.
Why did you say his mother?
Yeah. Okay.
Could the stars be a sort of a nod to... God telling Abraham his descendants are going to be greater than the
Yeah, that would be a natural connection. Just don't go too far with it. Just kind of look at the metaphors and what more will we learn about the dreams that these might symbolize or characterize at this point in time.
Do you think with the sheaths that it's like the food, the famine?
Ah, okay. Yeah, I think so. So the sheath, the first is an agricultural motif, right? So it's going to talk more about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Could that be the moon and stars?
Well, yeah, that's what they're representing for sure, okay. So, David, did you have a thought?
Well, I think it's interesting, the first one, it's his brothers rebuking him, then it's his father rebuking him.
Yeah.
So, I didn't do all the homework, but I looked at this and some commentators said it was like earthly dominion and heavenly dominion.
Yeah, I think we see that, and you see the first one is this agricultural motif, right? And I think it just is setting the stage for what we're going to see earlier, because remember, the dreams are basically conveying preeminence, right? So Joseph is going to have a degree of preeminence over his brothers and his parents. In the case of the sheaths, the agricultural motif is going to point to the supplying of food during the famine. And then the second one, the sun and the moon and the stars, I think really focuses more on the ruling motif, because he is going to rule, right? As he gets down to Egypt, he's going to become the number two guy in the land. And so we see kind of in these two things. Yeah, David.
And in Genesis, remember, if the sun was to govern the heavens by day and the moon.
Yes, exactly. So I think both of both these comments, you do see the kind of the idea back to the original, you know, your descendants and the quantity of them, but then also all the way back in Genesis, the things that are ruling over the day and over the night. So in that context, in that time, they would have understood a celestial type of example or illustration to mean ruling, because they looked at that. Now, obviously, there were sun gods and things like that. They're not referring to that, but we do see the context of that. So the two ways the family are going to exercise that. That's Jacob. Man, my Jacobs and Josephs are off today. Okay, this is going to kill me, so I have to put it. Oh. Okay. Sorry. Okay, so the two ways that Joseph is going to exercise his preeminence over the family. First, in providing for the family. Okay, so that's the first dream in verses 5 to 8. And then second, in ruling over the family, the second dream, which we find in verses 9 to 11. So we see a kind of a progression as well in the process as we go through it. Now, what or who is the source of the dreams? Where do these dreams come from?
God.
Okay, where do you get that?
Well, you see it fulfilled, so you know it's fulfilled.
Right, but we the text rules. Where do we get that from the text? Okay, this is a trick question. Roger is right, but it is a trick question. We're not told. Okay, remember, and the reason I want to make the point is, remember when Jacob had his dreams, it was very clear that the Lord was speaking to him. Okay, now, is God behind it? Yes, because God's providential in all things, but it doesn't say that God is speaking to Joseph here. So we don't know what the source of the dreams are. Clearly, they're going to come true. Clearly, they are prophetic in nature. Okay, so we would know that God is ultimately behind them, but it doesn't tell us in the text that it is. Why not? Because God wants us to focus on the content of the dreams and what they set up versus the source. Okay, so I think it's a pretty good conclusion that they are coming from God in some way, shape, or form. But the point here is not so much where they come from, but focusing on the content, which is what the author wants us to do. So let's take a look at the content. The first one in verses 5 to 8 employs this agricultural illustration to communicate its truth. Now, it's interesting in that Old Testament dreams share some similarity, literary similarity, let's say it that way, with the New Testament parables. Okay, so there's some things that they have in common. They both use common and true-to-life analogies or comparisons to make their points vivid, right? So if you think of New Testament parables, Jesus is always picking on something true-to-life that people can see and to relate to from the common world around them. Certainly, you know, harvesting and sheaves is something that we do. Secondly, they can be expressed as either similitudes, which means they're short and pithy, so that's kind of like proverbial-type statements, or in longer narrative-type stories or dreams, as we see here. They all have one major point of comparison, okay, which is intended to communicate one main idea. All right, so there is always one main idea as you look at these different things. They are designed, we know for sure, in the New Testament to both conceal truth from the hard-hearted, right? What do they say when they ask Jesus, why does he teach in parables? What's his response?
They may see and not see.
They may see and not see, and hear and not hear, okay? So it's concealing truth from the hard-hearted and revealing truth to those who embrace the truth. They differ primarily in that the New Testament parables communicate a spiritual truth. Okay, so they're common to regular use illustrations from everyday life, but there's a spiritual truth behind a New Testament parable, whereas the Old Testament dreams are providing revelation. Okay, so we are seeing revelation in the Old Testament dreams. But there are a lot of parallels between the two different things. So Joseph's first dream uses this harvest motif to communicate the truth, and we see most of the attributes that I just described. The brothers are in the field. They're binding the grain stalks into sheaves, and something we might see today in less developed countries in the world. Obviously in America, that's all done by machines, but if you go around the world, you certainly still see manual labor. I remember one time in college, I had a roommate somewhere down near Virginia Tech, and he owned a big tobacco farm. And if anybody has ever been on a tobacco farm and ever seen tobacco harvesting, you're nodding your head, you know it is what? Back-breaking work. You know, so these young, stupid college kids were brought down. He said, oh yeah, have some fun, do that. And after about 1 hour, I'm like, oh, are we done? And he just said, look at the rows. You're bending over and chopping those things and you're putting them on it. So you see a common thing, something we can relate to. You probably still see it in different places, okay? So they're gathering sheaves at the harvest in the field. We see the comparison element in that each sheaf is representing one of the brothers, okay? So we see the comparison there. You see some pithy and forceful language. You don't see it as much in the English, but in the Hebrew it's pretty clear, communicating kind of both Joseph, I got it right this time, Joseph's exuberance, right? So Joseph just can't wait to share this dream, probably reflecting a little bit of his naivete in youth, right? We're already told at the beginning he's 17 years old. But namely, there's a couple of things. First of all, you see at the beginning of this, he says, please. Now this is a specific Hebrew word, which is na, and basically it's a word of entreaty, okay? You're entreating somebody to do this. So, you know, you're saying, please, please, listen to me, or please, please, do something for me. So it's a very emphatic kind of use. Secondly, we see three times another Hebrew particle, which is hine, which is translated one of two ways. Either behold, which you see that twice, right? He says, behold, behold, and then you hear it, lo. So he's very, very emphatic in what he's doing in terms of how he's communicating what he wants them to hear. So you see some of those markers. The main point of the dream is preeminence, right? The brothers' sheaths are going to bow down to Joseph's sheath. So we can't really miss that. Obviously, the brothers don't miss that implication as they hear the dreams. But what aspect of the dream is revealed? Or better, what part of the dream do the brothers fully grasp? What do they fully get out of the dream? What part's clear to them? That they're going to be bowing down to him. Okay, so there's going to be a level of preeminence over them. Now, how do we know they get this meaning?
They say it.
And how else do we know?
They hated him
even more, right? Okay, so they hated him even more. Now, it's interesting how this is constructed. If you look at 5 to 8, and the second part of verse 5 and 8b is something called an inclusio. Basically, it means that you see the same words to begin a narrative and end a narrative. So you can think of them like parentheses, and it tells you there's something in the middle. The dream starts with the end in sight. So we see this structure a couple times. As the narrative comes across to us, as the readers, we're told what's going on, right? So look in verse 5. It starts out and says, then Joseph had a dream, and when they told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. So we have the essence right up front. Then he goes on to give us the dream, and then at the end of it, in 8b, it says, are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words, okay? So it's an encapsulated type of thing, and it's strong emotion. I mean, think about hatred, right? It's a strong word, isn't it? I mean, I hate something. I used to throw that word around all the time, right? Kind of like a little throwaway. Oh, yeah, I hate that, or I hate that. But boy, as I became a believer and my life started to change, I thought a lot about that word. That is a really, really strong word. To hate something is really to despise it, to have total disdain for it. And so it's a very strong emotion that they're seeing. Now, in 8b, the hate is reinforced along with the reasons. Okay, so what are the reasons for their hatred?
The reign and rule.
Yeah, okay. First, they hate him for the content of the dream, right? So they hate him for what the sense of content is, and they hate, so the dream itself, and they hate him for announcing it, all right? So look at what it says at the end of verse 8, right? So they hated him even more, why? For his dreams, right? So they didn't like the content at all. But furthermore, they didn't like the fact that he told them. Right? So you see kind of the two parts. So if he'd had the dream and hadn't said anything, they'd be going wrong, happy, dumb, and not caring any different. But the fact is he both had the dream and he told them what the dream was. Okay? So they hit him for both of those things. Now, what aspect of the dream's meaning is concealed at this point? What part of it is concealed? What part don't they get?
Well, the whole famine thing. I mean, they don't see how that could possibly come true.
Right.
Do you think that part of it, not only did he tell them a dream, but he did it in kind of an arrogant way?
Oh, sure.
You know, he said, oh, I have this dream that just is so disturbing, or, you know, but he didn't. He said,
behold, and lo, and he lorded it over him. Yeah, David.
It seems kind of ironic that this dream is somewhat what provoked the whole providential location.
Yeah, very interesting. We'll get to that in just a second. Okay, and particularly as we get into the conspiracy and kind of how God uses Amber.
I had a question, like, why Jacob, if back in verse 32, Jacob wrestles with God and sees him face to, or back in chapter 32, Jacob wrestles with God, sees him face to face, has this encounter with God. Why Jacob didn't go, I've had that encounter too, son. Like, he almost gave license to the sons to...
Well, here's what I would say to you, if you'll hang on for just a second. When you get into verse, the second part of the dream, how does Jacob react to it? What's it say in the last part of verse 11?
He kept the saying. He
kept the saying in his mind.
Right. Now, why would he have kept the saying in mind? Why was his rebuke so light?
Pondering him in his heart, you mean?
Yeah, he kept it in mind. He kind of pondered it. He basically understood how God communicates through dreams.
Right.
And because of just that reason, I think, Amber, because of the vividness of his dreams back in chapter 32.
Serious. Okay.
Yeah.
That was what, like you were... Just to piggyback on what
you
were saying, the boys kind of get licensed to hate him even more because Jacob didn't go, we need to stop and listen to this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Jacob
could have said, let me tell you, sons, God does communicate with us. This could be something, you know.
So look, I think you can kind of stop for a second and draw a broader implication, and that is you see some pretty poor parenting on Jacob's part. Through all of this. I mean, he's going to expose his son to things as we move through the story. You know, you're absolutely right. He could have clearly said, hey, guys, come on, settle down here. I mean, God talked to me in a dream and it all came true, so it could very well be true. Now, it doesn't say these are from God, but Jacob certainly would have understood kind of the profundity of dreams based upon his experiences. First, he had the Jacob's ladder, and then he actually wrestled with God himself. So he had those experiences. So then, as you already said, Betty, you know, the expression of the Joseph's dream is what they don't get. Okay, now it's okay they don't get it. I mean, they got the key part, which is the preeminence. They just don't know how that preeminence is going to work itself out relative to this particular dream. And we don't either, right? Because we don't know until chapter 42. But since we all read ahead, right, we know what's going on.
Well, and we have Bible prophecy for our future.
Right.
And we don't know how it's going to play out.
Exactly right.
I mean, there's a lot of people who have written fiction novels based on it, you know, with their imagination of how it could work out. But we don't see it.
No, you're right. Exactly. Yeah, I think of 1 John, you know, we will see him face to face and, you know, we'll see him just as he is, but we don't know what that is now. So, there's an awful lot. The whole book of Revelation, that's what it makes it hard to read and study the book. I mean, then you got all these experts saying this is that, and da 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 da. It's like, not so fast. But so obviously we know the story here, but they don't. So the brothers miss the intent of the agricultural motif as simply reigning, which he is going to do. But the first stage of that is going to be his providing for them, as for the whole world at that time, through the famine. Well, if that wasn't enough, Joseph has another dream, which he also announces rather exuberantly. So apparently he is just thick in the head, or doesn't quite care what his brothers think. Because here we go again. Lo and behold, in verse 9, I had another dream. This dream employs a celestial metaphor, and now includes not only the brothers, but what? His mother and his father, right? The sun and the moon and the 11 stars. So it's a very clear allusion to his mother, father, and the brothers, okay? And now He's going to again express his preeminence. And what part of this preeminence is concealed? What part of this preeminence is concealed?
Well, God elevates Joseph to that position of being second in the whole kingdom of Egypt, and they all ultimately come seeking food and bow down to him.
Right, exactly. So the means by which Joseph is going to come about, right, which is not going to be revealed to us again until a little later when he becomes effectively the prime minister of Egypt, okay? So again, the point is clear, but how that's going to be brought about is part of what the developing story is, just as Ken noted, okay? So as we're going to keep getting more and more data, we just know what it is at this point in time. Now, what's interesting about Jacob's response to the dream? We kind of covered this just a little bit. What's interesting about it?
I wonder if this is.
I wonder, okay? So in that context, his rebuke is quite mild, right? And it's expressed in the form of two questions, right? He asks two questions. Now, what's notably absent? It's notably absent of any strong emotion, and why is that? Gets back to Larry's point. Because he understands the import of dreams, right? So Jacob knows something is going on here. He suspects that something will come true because he himself experienced dreams in his life and the fact that those dreams did come true, okay? So we kind of see that process going. Now, there's something else that's interesting about his response. What else is interesting about Jacob's response?
I kind of got the impression that it was okay for his brothers to be bowing down, but
that's interesting. I'm looking for something different, but yeah, it's like, okay, it's okay for the kids, but not me and mom.
Me and mom,
forget that part. What else is interesting?
His mother's dead at this point, though. Is that
anything? Yeah, it could, yeah, no, it's not that. It's a little tricky, but he interprets the dream, right? So he actually interprets the dream, right? Look at 10b. What does he say? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground? Okay, so we have the moon, the stars, you know, the sun, the moon, and the stars. It's just a celestial motif at that point in time. But in his questions and then his statement at the end, he basically is interpreting the dream. And he's interpreting correctly. Now, again, nobody's really confused about this, but the fact is it's interesting that he responds in that particular way. Not so the brothers. What is their response? How do they respond? Okay, so they add another emotion to their hatred, right? They add jealousy, and they're kind of partners in crime, aren't they? Hatred and jealousy, the two go hand in hand. Now, the Bible has a lot to say about jealousy, and I just wanted to look at it a little bit before we leave the dream motif here. So let's kind of look through a couple passages. Start in Proverbs. Let's go to chapter 6 and verse 34. Proverbs 6 in chapter 6 and verse 34. We have this. Proverbs 6 verse 34. What does it say? For jealousy, what? Enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. Okay, so jealousy is a pretty strong, passionate emotion, right, that really finds its way out in some kind of physical type things at times in the process. Page over a little further to chapter 14 and verse 30. What do we say? A tranquil heart is life to the body, but passion, it's the same Hebrew word as jealousy, is rottenness to the bones, right? So it's kind of a decaying type of thing. It's rottenness to our bones in the process. And then finally, one more in Proverbs here. Go to chapter 27 and verse 4. Okay, wrath is fierce and anger is a flood, but who can stand before jealousy? So think about that, right? So wrath is fierce and anger is like a flood, but who can stand before jealousy? So you think about jealousy. You think about jealousy in relationships and how much of a killer that can be. And jealousy leads to controlling behavior, directing behavior, all kinds of different things. So We see that the writer of Proverbs has a lot to say about it. Go to Acts chapter 5 and verse 17. Okay, Acts 5, 17. We just see a similar pattern that talks to the source of jealousy, right? Acts 5 and verse 17 says this. Okay, but the high priest rose up along with all his associates, that is the sect of the Sadducees, and they were filled with what?
Jealousy.
Okay, what were they jealous about? Well, the apostles' preeminence with the people, right? So we're jealous frequently about the preeminence of others as we see it. 1 Corinthians 3:3, we know it's a source of division, okay? And then let's go to James chapter 3, verses 14 to 16. James talks about this as wisdom from below. So James chapter 3, verses 14 to 16, what does it say? Starts here. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, the condition, in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This is wisdom. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, and demonic. For while jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. So jealousy is a pretty strong disruptor, is the point that we see. It's not the kind of wisdom that comes from below, it's the kind of wisdom that comes from, from above, but the kind of wisdom that comes from below. So we see kind of some strong things there. Then, of course, the antidote, right? So look at 1 Corinthians 3. What's the antidote to jealousy? The antidote to all things. 1 Corinthians 13, in verse 4. Great chapter on love, of course, right? 13:4. What does it say? Love is patient. Love is kind. And what? Not jealous. Okay, doesn't brag. Well, look at love. And Joseph was bragging probably. Certainly invoked some of the jealousy. And then Psalm 37 kind of is another antidote. Let's look at that last one there. Psalm 37 verses 1 to 4 kind of says it well, I think. Okay, so a Psalm of David here, Psalm 37 verses 1 to 4. Do not fret because of evildoers. Be not envious, there's that word jealousy, toward wrongdoers. For they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell on the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. So there is kind of an appropriate jealousy, isn't there? A jealousy for the Lord, a jealousy for what the Lord wants, a jealousy for the desires of the Lord to be the desires of your heart. And as we dwell in that kind of biblically good jealousy, God will grant the things of our heart. But it's when we start directing it out towards other things and other people that we don't want, that's when we start to see jealousy become this disruptive factor. Okay? So, big topic in the Bible, and we leave these dreams here with both hatred and jealousy. Roger.
I got a question about dream number 2.
Yeah?
He talks about the sun, the moon, and the stars.
Right.
At that time, Egypt was definitely worshiping the sun, the moon, and the stars.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So does that kind of indicate where this may all occur?
Well, could be. Yeah, could be. I mean, it could be an indication of where it's going to come about, right? Because we do know that. And as we get into, or if we ever get to Exodus at some point in time, we look at the plagues, right? There, all those plagues are attacking the many gods of Egypt. And the darkness, the sun god was a preeminent god in Egypt. Mm-hmm. So the fact that, you know, they're darkened, their big dude god is overcome would be a great shock to their system. But yeah, it could be. They would have known that. It could have also, I mean, Egypt was rampant with it. Could very well have been in Canaan as well. I mean, it certainly had a lot of different worship and a lot of different gods and so forth. So yeah, I think we see some of that there. Yeah, Jim.
I've done a couple of things we mentioned this already. You don't think there's any significance in what he said about your mother and I bowing down before you?
Yeah, I didn't.
She was already dead?
Yeah, I didn't look at that very closely. It kind of, there's a good example of not observing very well.
Okay, I'm just wondering why you
because
he obviously said it. And
yeah.
I was wondering how that could be.
Yeah, and that she's gone and so forth. Yeah, so who knows who he's referring to, right?
Well,
mother.
Your mother.
Right, right. Your mother, she's dead, but...
He was the one that was talking, so he was talking to that.
He could have said your mothers and made it easier for us, right? All the different wives that were there. But to some extent, maybe it's just a category of whoever his, you know, kind of other parental figures were. But yeah, I didn't look very closely at that. I'll go back and look at that next week and see if there's
any... I never really thought of that before, but
yeah.
The fact that she was dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could the dream just sort of imply that it was going to involve the entire family unit?
Yeah, you know, I think that's kind of where it's coming from, and not necessarily a clearly literal mm-hmm. your particular mother mm-hmm. or the mothers. Now, I don't know.
I mean, the slaves, the, you know, extended family. It's
right.
More than just the 11 sons that end up in Egypt.
Well, and I wonder who, you know, when his mother had died, somebody would have still kind of taken care of him and been over him. It could have been a maid or a maidservant or somebody else. It could have been one of the ones, right? Bilhah or Zilpah kind of thing. So it's probably a general thing. It is interesting. I'm trying to think back. And the different ones that I read and looked at, nobody really made any point about it. And I didn't see it when I read it. So don't know that it's terribly significant, but I'll look again. And see what's...
It really doesn't tell us.
Yeah, it doesn't tell us.
Think. Why would
you
include that?
But it's good. I mean, I think it's good. Whenever you're observing the text like that and asking questions of the text, that's really what the Lord wants us to do. Because when we're dwelling on the questions, what are we dwelling on?
God's Word,
right? You know? And so you can't ever go wrong with that. One of my Old Testament my theology professor used to say that oftentimes we dwell on God's Word and we get to something he calls blessed despair. He would reference Psalm 145 and verse 3. Blessed despair is when you're meditating on God's word, you're trying to figure out what it is, kind of like God's will, our will, and God's sovereignty, things like that. It leads you to what? Blessed despair, because you ain't ever going to figure it out. And he said, so what that should do is drive you to your knees and worship him aright, which is ultimately, you know, anytime you're dwelling on God's word, anytime you're thinking about and trying to think through, God in some way, shape, or form is going to honor and work through that because you're dwelling on what he's saying. But oftentimes it's just submission. That's the thing he's driving to in some of those things, and we submit and we just give it to him in the process. So yeah. Okay, I think one big implication here out of all this is this idea that we might resent who God places over us, but we should expect his sovereignty in this matter, right? Now, has God ever placed anybody over you that you resented just a bit? Okay, you can nod your head and not give names. Okay, that's good. Don't give names. But look, you know, we often question sometimes, right, who God puts over us, okay? Now, why should we not question who God puts over us? Can you think of a scriptural principle for that?
The Bible says God's placing the people in authority.
Yeah.
He's choosing.
He does. That's right. You can see Romans 13.
We're voting them into office,
right.
But he's the one who's...
Yeah, God puts governments in place for our good. But what is it? How is it that God chooses?
According to his purpose.
According to his will.
Right. Think of a scripture when he talks about it. Thinking maybe when he's selecting David, right? The ruddy little boy? Yeah.
The man looks on the outside.
Yeah, okay. So turn to 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7, okay? You know, we tend to look at the outside, right? So remember the first king, Saul, right? What did they say about Saul? He was the tallest guy in the land, the most handsome, the big, strong, ruddy guy, right? And then we go on to David, right? He goes to David's family, looks at this must be the one, all right? Then the puny little youngest kid comes in, David, right? And in verse six, chapter 16 and verse 7 of 1 Samuel, they said this. In verse 6, when they entered, he looked at Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before me. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. Why? For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Okay, so, you know, oftentimes God works through characters and people that we really question, right? I mean, it's the humble, it's the quiet, but it's the strength of heart that he's looking at in the process. So we see that obviously as this narrative continues and we see how Joseph grows, we see an amazingly strong heart in him, don't we? I mean, the very fact that he can get to the end of all this and say, you guys meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, and not have any bitterness or hard-hearted about this, is really, I think, one of the most amazing statements that we see in the Bible. I wish I could come even a little bit close every now and then. Okay, so we leave this dream scene with a clear sense of the family's reaction to the dreams, but we are left with one more tension before we leave, right? So we have the dreams, we know what they are, so kind of what's the one tension? We know that the essence of the dreams is preeminence, so what's the one tension that we leave with before we go on to the rest of the story? Okay, they're all very clear. He's going to be the man. So what's kind of the one thought that might be in our minds as we leave this before we get any more detail?
Jacob knew what it meant. And didn't.
Say it again.
Jacob knew what the dream meant. And
right.
Didn't bring it to the attention of.
Okay, well, it's possible. Okay. Joseph knew what the dream meant. And kind of what's what might come to your mind? Maybe it's just my warped little mind that comes up with these things. All right, well, here's one thought I had. He's really exuberant, right? Perhaps naively so about his dreams. What we kind of leave with is we don't know if this preeminence is going to find its expression in benevolence or cruelty, right? So he is going to be preeminent. We know that. Now, maybe we don't think about this because we know the rest of the story,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. We know.
And we think we know what's coming. But, you know, it's a developing story. Right, it's not a Paul Harvey story where this is the rest of the story, okay? And now for the rest of the story. The fact of the matter is, at this point, we don't know whether it's going to work itself out benevolently, which it's going to. We do know that from reading. Or whether cruelty. I mean, Joseph could have gone either way. Yeah, Bobby.
It's just funny that they wouldn't think of it as could go either way. They would just jump to the conclusion that it has to be a bad thing.
Right. And why do you think they jumped to that conclusion?
Evil.
They're evil. That's how their whole life has been. Yeah, David.
They may not have picked up on this, but when Joseph was talking to Pharaoh through those dreams to Pharaoh, the Lord meant, because it was repeated twice, that it was sure, like the thing is sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if they would have picked up on that from there. But
yeah, I mean the repetition of the
means
of the thing.
Like it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. That's right. I think both the fact that the general point, the main point of both of them is preeminence, right, which we've talked about. It's repeated from two different perspectives. It's actually ratcheted up, right? First your brothers, then the whole family, right? So clearly they know what that is. And, you know, in their mindset, right, they would be thinking, oh, he's going to lord it over us. He's going to do this. And look, even at the end of the book, right, what does it say? Okay, Jacob finally dies. What's their first thought?
Now he's really going to get us.
Yeah, now we're going to get it, right? Now we're going to get it. But no, what? What does he say? No, brothers, I'm not dear that. God, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, so I could sustain you and bring you along. So again, we see this kind of, you know, amazing maturity. So he's rather immature, perhaps, at this point, in terms of how he expressed what he heard. But we see unbelievable maturity further on as we see him living out his life and the things that he does. Okay? All right. So now we move on to the next scene here, scene 3. Somebody read verses 12 to 17.
Brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them. And he said to them, I will go. He said to him, I will go. Then he said to him, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. A man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, what are you looking for? He said, I am looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock. Then the man said, they have moved from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan.
Okay, so the dream's done, and now we have this third scene, which I've called the errand. It opens up with the brothers' departure to pasture the flock, and apparently Joseph is left behind, or told to be stay back by his father. The text is not determinative, but given his father's favoritism, I suspect he probably held him back. And what is interesting about where the brothers choose to pasture? Where are they pasturing them? Where do they go first?
Not where their dad told them to.
Yeah. Where do they go first?
Shechem.
Shechem. What's interesting about Shechem? Isn't that the place where they whacked all the people? What are they doing going back there? Right? You know, so they go back to Shechem first to pasture the land. There's a lot of pasture land out there. So why is it they go back there? Okay? I don't really know. Okay? Maybe it's going to go back to their scene of the dirty deeds. With all the land available, I have many questions about their choice. Maybe they like to live dangerously. Okay? Hey, we got them once before. Let's go see how they're doing now. Okay? Maybe they're exerting their strength, or maybe they're just camping out. Remember, Jacob had bought land there. So maybe they went back and they made that their base camp and they did things all around it. The point is, it doesn't say, it just reports that's where they originally went when they went back. So Jacob dispatches Joseph to check on the brothers' flocks' welfare, on the brothers' and the flocks' welfare. Okay, so he wants them to check on both things, and he wants to come back and do that. Now, what's troubling about Jacob's request? What's troubling about his request?
Well, if he'd have been a good father with any element of discernment, he may have known that his brothers were jealous, and this could be a very precarious position for the son.
Extremely well said. I mean, no regard whatsoever for his son's potential safety, right? I mean, this is a consecutive narrative, okay? They just went through this whole thing. It's clear the brothers have hatred and jealousy for him, and so he doesn't seem to have any regard for his safety. So we see poor parenting. Maybe he's just oblivious to the possibility. Again, the text doesn't give us any insight, but as you're reading the story, it just strikes me, what in the world is he thinking that he would dispatch him out to do that? Now,
he could have sent a servant or something to
sure.
check.
He could have sent anybody.
How old is Joseph at this point?
Well, it starts off, he's 17, remember? So the narrative is pretty continuous. He's a young guy. Now, in that time, I mean, he was considered a man, but certainly a young man by all measures. Yeah, Roger.
Following Betty's idea, he's held him back from going out to the flock to begin with.
Right.
Why wouldn't he send a servant?
Right. Okay. So, you know, again, poor parenting, complete obliviousness. Maybe, again, how could I believe they'd do that? Yeah.
I always thought, too, what about a mistrust of all the other brothers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Joseph clearly was his favorite. And why would he have to send anybody out to check up on
right.
what they were doing? Did he not trust that they would
right.
do what he asked them to do?
Yeah, well, that's probably true, actually. Mm-hmm. So maybe Joseph had already displayed some of his character at this age of 17. The brothers so far have had three acts, right? What is mm-hmm. what has Reuben done so far?
Slept
with his father's wife. What did Simeon and Levi do?
They killed
a whole bunch of people through a deceptive deal. Okay, we're going to get to another fourth brother next week, right? Judah. He's not going to do so well, right? So the fact of the matter is that he's probably got good reason not to trust these sons, and to wonder what in the world they're doing, what kind of trouble they're stirring up. But yet, you know, no regard really for Joseph.
Right.
Yeah, Jack.
I mean, you know, given the nature of a lot of these people, the most obvious answer is that you wanted Joseph to be eliminated.
Yeah, you mean the father? Yeah, which is kind of ironic, isn't it? Given that he's the favorite and everything else. Yeah, yeah, interesting. Good thought. Okay, so what's notable about Joseph's response? What's notable about Joseph's response? Yeah, I'm all in, Pop.
I'm all in. Right.
Simple obedience, right? Along with an element of faith, seemingly having no concern for his safety. So he's either dirt stupid, right? Which I'm not sure he is, as we're going to find out from the narrative, or just completely bereft of any sense of his brother's feelings towards him, right? Or he's obedient and he has faith, right? Which, of course, we're going to see, I believe, right? Borne out as we continue through the story. But it is kind of a surprising response, right? Mm-hmm. Sure, Pop, let me go to see those guys. Amber.
Isn't there an element of more masculinity in that culture to begin with?
Yeah.
Like you'd see today, like...
You mean like guys get all kind of puffy and...
Yeah, just the agricultural...
Yeah, could be, yeah. I mean, there's just a lot of things that could be. But, you know, look at it. If I had 11 brothers and they hated me, I probably would be a little reticent to go that far away and go check things out. Yeah, Roger.
It also just shows God's providence.
Yeah, yeah.
He's walking the whole thing down the road.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the kind of the meta narrative we always keep in mind. A lot of the commentators say this chapter is the greatest chapter of providence in all of Genesis. I'm like, really? What about all the other chapters? It looks like he's got things under control pretty good. But the fact is we do see a lot of it, right? And we see kind of more the working of that providence as we go through the steps here. But certainly we do see that. Okay, so Joseph departs for Shechem from Hebron, and he moves on to Dothan. So just to give you a little perspective, right? So Hebron's down here, right? So from Hebron to Shechem is about 50 miles. So 2 to 3 days journey, all right? And then from Shechem up to Dothan, which is kind of a bit to the northwest up there, another 20 miles or so, okay? So, you know, you can get back to the manly thing here. Yeah, Pop, I can take it, right? He's all by himself in a foreign land. He's a young guy. So it's a pretty risky journey that he's going on, but it seems his father has trust in him and he goes through the process. So just give you a sense of kind of where all this is happening, okay? And then he moved on. Now, I think we're going to stop here because I don't want to get into the conspiracy because we only got a few minutes left and I have to go north in the process. So how about any questions, comments, thoughts in terms of what we've seen here so far? Okay, so we've seen this chapter. We've seen kind of a lot of kind of parallels from Joseph and Christ. We kind of set it up that way. We saw the initial introduction to the whole narrative in verses 1 to 4. We see these dreams, which set the plot line for what we see. Now Joseph's back out, and then we're going to get to the next two big pieces, right? So the kind of centerpiece or the climax of this whole thing are the next set of verses where we're going to see the conspiracy. Okay, so how are the brothers going to receive him and deal with him? And then finally, what does it end with in the last set of verses? Once again, the family DNA, what? Deception, right? Deception. So we'll see how those two things work out. So next week we'll pick it up there and get through chapter 38. I hope, because I got to give Doug a clean start on chapter 39. So I'll be here next week, and then the week after that, I will be in Haiti with Mark. And so Doug will be here with us, and Doug Emmett, and share with us from chapter 39. And I want to give him a clean starting point. Chapter 38 is kind of an interesting chapter, has some kind of key high points, and we'll take a look at those. All right, so any other questions? Any other thoughts?
Well, I would like to say before we leave, just because nobody said it, I don't think. Is this kind of event that seems to be very innocuous, very just regular sort of a nothing event, just, oh, well, he needs to go up there and go do that.
Right.
Those are the kind of events that God uses in our lives that actually turn out to be more significant than we might have ever imagined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I just got to Publix and grabbed a gallon of milk and got
right.
a car wreck.
Yeah.
And God's designed this.
Mm-hmm.
For his glory, for your good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just things like that that happen all the time to us.
Right.
It's not something to easily just write off. Or, you
know. No, I think it's a great point, Scott. A little later I talk about it, I use big and small, but part of what we see in God's providence here, which I think is an excellent point, is that he is at work in things big and small, right? So it seems like a matter-of-fact type of event, right? Go up and check on the brothers, right? Yeah, okay, I'll go check on the brothers. But yet, in all this process, and then you're going to see this conspiracy, right? And they're going to think they've done something to get this to where it's never going to happen, right? And then what happens? It actually catalyzes God's fulfillment of all those things. So yeah, I think Scott makes a good point. I mean, you know, as we go through day-to-day life, we all tend to think about, well, what's God's will in the big things, right? Or what's he want for this? Or what's he want for this? What's his will for my life? Does he want me to marry that girl or that guy? But he's active in all the little things of our lives. And in fact, it's many of the more inconsequential things where we have the more significant results. So thank you for sharing that. It's very good.